QSO Today, episode 494, Fred Hoppengarten, K1VR. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. This week I want to thank Larry Classy, W4LEC, and Lawrence Howell, KL7L, who became listener sponsors. There were anonymous donations as well, and I want to thank them for their donations. All of these sponsorships and donations pay for the services and server hosting, legal fees to protect the QSO Today brand, and the product and services that we use to create and post the QSO Today podcast and the QSO Today Academy videos. Historically, only 6% of our regular listeners support the QSO Today project in any way. Please show your support at any level today. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio? Do people still do that?" This podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. I learned this week that my guest on episode 199 and repeated on episode 444, Adam Farson, AB4OJ and VA7OJ, is now a silent key. I got to meet Adam in person when he received a Technical Achievement Award at the Dayton Hamvention in 2022. Go back and play QSO Today episode 444 if you've not already heard it. He was a fine human being and a great amateur radio Elmer. May his memory be for a blessing. Fred Hoppengarten, K1VR, and his wife Betty were guests in my home after an afternoon of touring with me the unusual sites around Jerusalem and Gush Etzion, where I live, a few years ago. Fred has a long history in amateur radio and took to the law rather than engineering as a profession, specializing in communications law and antenna regulations for both commercial broadcasting and amateur radio. His book, Antenna Zoning for the Radio Amateur, is a must-read for hams that need and want external antennas at their QTH. K1VR and I discuss antenna law, contesting, and his elaborate station in this QSO Today. K1VR, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Fred?
Hi, Eric, 4Z1UG. This is K1VR.
Fred, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. I have to say to the listeners that you and I met here in Israel, I think it was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, you brought your wife, Betty, and we did a tour of Jerusalem and Gush Etzion, which is where I live, and had a barbecue at my house. It was a great first meeting, and we talked a little bit about amateur radio, but when you're visiting Israel, we seem to be talking more about what's happening here. So it's good to see you again after 2 years, Fred. Let's just start at the very beginning of your ham radio story. When and how did it start for you?
I was an 8-year-old Cub Scout. We had a Boy Scout associated with the Cub Scout troop who happened to be a shortwave listener. And I had a radio from my father's dental office that he had decided to discard because the audio quality wasn't very good. He gave it to me to take home. And the Boy Scout said, you know, if we took off one plate from the capacitor, you could listen to KCA 692, the Newton Police Department. And I thought that was fascinating. He did it. And from there, when he noticed I was really interested in that, he said, I have an old S38B I can sell you for $25 if you'd like, because I've upgraded to an S54. Hallicrafter's receiver. So my first shortwave radio was an S38B. The year was 1954. I was first licensed as a novice in 1956 at the age of 10.
So you got your first radio in 1954. And obviously it sounded to me like the Newton Police Department was close by. So your hometown was Newton, Massachusetts?
Correct.
if the police department was down there, they were not in VHF and UHF in those days. They were just below the broadcast band or just above the broadcast band?
That's correct.
Like Car 54, where are you?
The big whips and AM communications.
So you got your license in 1956. How old were you in 1956?
10 years old. It was an interesting experience because I had to learn long division in order to pass the exam.
Isn't that funny? You know, I'm working with a young boy right now who's 10 years old. He just turned 10. He wants an amateur radio license really badly, but he doesn't do math yet. So he had to learn his times tables. And I said, if you learn your times tables, it opens the world to you. So he learns his times tables in a week. He comes back to me and we start doing long division. His like brain exploded that he has this power now just because he knows the times table. I thought that was kind of cool. So at age 10, as a novice, you actually had to learn Ohm's law and long division.
Yes, that presented its own problem because Ohm's law is an algebraic equation and has three components. Since I didn't know algebra and couldn't manipulate letters and the around the equals sign, I had to simply memorize all six forms.
So you were able to work your way around the lack of math knowledge in order to be able to master, or at least to take the test. So you have the S38. What was the first transmitter then that you had as a novice?
Upon licensing, I learned through the son of a friend of my father, who was WN1IEF at the time, that one of his neighbors in Brookline, Paul Ryack, W1ETH, later to become W1PR, W1 Paul Ryack, nowadays a physician living in California, that Paul had built a 6L6 QST transmitter, and he was willing to sell me this homemade, crystal-controlled, 80 and 40 meters only transmitter for $25. So my station cost $50 in total.
But in 1956 dollars, that was quite a bit.
Sure enough.
It was a month's pay for a working class guy.
Got me on the air, ran a piece of bell wire purchased at a local hardware store out the window. There was a link on the back of this homemade transmitter, and I would put a light bulb across it and tune for maximum light bulb power. Ran the wire out the window. It was about 12 feet high. Its entire length, except for the very last part where I had to throw it over a branch and because it was about 18 feet. So it was just an end-fed, random length, it was probably about 65 feet, wire. That was the antenna.
For 80 and 40?
Correct.
How did that work for you?
Contacts were a struggle because on a good day, the 6L6 output was 30 watts, 25 watts. You know, it was a 6AG7 and a 6L6 classic 1950s crystal control transmitter.
I think it's kind of unusual that you're age 10. Were you a part of an amateur radio club there in Newton during those days? And how did they accept a youngster?
Well, first of all, I had no family members who had ever been engineers or radio hams. Second, there wasn't a Newton club. I would later find out there was a Waltham club in adjacent town. I went through the call book, basically contacting every radio ham in Newton, saying, where do you live and can I come by and visit? And eventually I found somebody who would drive me to a meeting of the Waltham Club. And they were very, I still think of them as very welcoming. There are guys to this day that I still know who were members of that club, W1MHL. And by the time I was age 12, I was out on field day with them. And the Middlesex Amateur Radio Club, for that field day, we used W1HEB.
Was this a time when there were a lot of kids, maybe from the scouts, who were becoming amateur radio licensees? And, I mean, did you build up your own chevre around ham radio there?
Yeah, you might say it that way. I'll tell you the one thing I did learn from going out on field day with the W1MHL, W1HEB crowd was don't put your sleeping bag on rocks and sleep overnight because the rocks will just drain all the heat out of your body. It was one very ugly night's sleep. What did I learn from those times? I learned not to sleep on rocks without a pad. Next, there were people around, but mostly I was finding people I could, within bicycle distance of my house, so I could go visit them.
Did those people become your Elmers? You've been a ham now for over 60, 70 years.
You're good at arithmetic. 1956 to 2006 would be 50 years.
70 years a ham. So, and you've been quite successful as a ham. Did you have Elmers that were willing to kind of show you the ropes, teach you how to do all of the stuff, make all the mistakes, work with high voltage?
One of the teenagers I became friendly with when I was about 14 or 15 was K1MMB, who is today TZ4AM and living in Mali. So there are some people I'm still in touch with to this day. He stays here every time he comes back to the Boston area to attend a reunion of his high school, Belmont Hill School in Belmont, Massachusetts.
Where he might be the only one there at this rate. Have you been to your 75th high school reunion yet? I can't imagine that you have. Not yet, but...
Not yet, but I will tell you that we did have a big high school reunion from the 1963 class of Newton South High School. And the funniest thing about that was that instead of holding the reunion here in the Boston area, we're all from Newton, Massachusetts, we held it in Central Florida because more of the class willing to work on the reunion lived in...
It's warmer, too, perhaps.
They did something very clever. They held it in the shoulder season. The rates were really inexpensive.
You have this interest in amateur radio from the time that you're 10 years of age. You get through high school. Did this interest in radio and stuff make a difference in terms of how you chose to educate yourself after high school? Did you want to become a radio engineer, electronics engineer?
Well, I got a big time clue when I took the SATs in the college application process, and my math score was 40 or 50 points lower than my English score. So I really never aimed toward engineering or physics or science at all. I was just always better at reading and writing. I went to a liberal arts college, Colby College in Waterville, Maine, graduating from there, going on to law school at Boston College Law School, graduating from there and going on to business school at Harvard Business School. So I spent 9 years of my youth going to college, as it were. There was, by that time, no radio station at Boston College, no ham radio station. There never was a station at Colby College, but there was at Harvard W1AF, the oldest, some would say, continuously operating amateur radio club in the United States, or the oldest. That turns out to be a competition between Worcester Polytech W1YK and MIT W1MX. Harvard and MIT have longstanding competitions in all sorts of ways.
And right now, the background that you're using is the Harvard Library.
They have some library because my wife wouldn't tolerate me being on a podcast with the mess that is actually over my shoulders. This is the school library, that's correct. But it's the largest business library in the world.
When you were here, you told me that you actually have family association with Brandeis. There was a museum. The museum was at Brandeis, not at Harvard?
Right. The Rose Art Museum at Brandeis University is after parts of my mother's family. My mother was Doris Rose. There was a major controversy when Brandeis tried to close the art museum, and I made a big stink on behalf of the family, wound up with an 8-column story in the Jerusalem Post I may have sent you. But in any event, the Rose Art Museum did not close. We did have to sue Brandeis, and eventually they simply settled and the problem went away.
And now there's still art there.
There's still a museum and still art there because the family donation was in several parts, a donation to create the building, the Rose Art Museum, a donation to buy art called the Rose Art Purchase Fund, and a donation to maintain the building, so that the university had really no complaint that it was costing them money to keep the art museum open.
Right. It was all self-funding from its inception.
It's open today and free to the public. It's a great place to visit if you're in the Boston area.
Would you say that you were active in the W1AF radio club when you were at Harvard? And how did your ham radio activity play during this 9 years in school?
Ham radio played no part at all. And, well, I shouldn't say that. In college, I actually entered sweepstakes a couple of times. I brought an NCX3 up to the campus in Waterville, Maine. I came in number two in the sweepstakes in fall of 1963, losing the number one spot in the state of Maine by something like 12 QSOs. That was pretty painful, but the antenna was just terrible. It was, again, an NFED random wire out of dormitory window. I tried a couple more times in college to operate sweepstakes, but it was not a great success. I knew next to nothing about antennas. It was a liberal arts college. There was nobody to call upon. And in classic proof that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed are kings, I became the chief engineer of the college radio station.
Did you get a commercial radio license in order to be able to sign their log as the engineer?
No, because it was a carrier current license and no necessary. It is today an FM radio station with good coverage, but not back then.
So carrier current, for the new listeners, is you're actually transmitting into the AC wiring of the building.
Correct. You could only hear us in most of the dorms on campus, but not all.
If I go to your website, you actually were quite prolific in terms of writing articles for ham radio magazines, including antenna articles. There was a tri-band, like long wire or something like that, that you wrote for 73 Magazine. How did you end up writing articles, technical articles, for the amateur radio magazines?
Oh, I made friends. That's the answer. The 73 article you're talking about was feeding a beverage antenna on both ends when I was in the cable TV business. I had access. I literally used to buy RG59 by the, and RG6 by the mile in the cable TV business. So I just nicked a couple hundred feet, fed the beverage at both ends, wrote it up, and the way I was able to get it published was that I was good friends with Bob Clark, N1RC, himself an MIT graduate. So he sort of he knew how to make it happen, and I can read and write. So I put it into words. And then the tri-bander thing you're talking about was an article that appeared in February 1992 QST with a co-author named Dean Straw, N6BV, who was working for ARRL and has subsequently retired himself, a graduate of Yale with a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. And what I had done with my friend K1EA, Ken Wolf, is sometimes my role is not to do the engineering, but to ask the right question. I told Ken that I had a 100-foot tower and a couple of TH6s, and I was wondering if it was possible to stack them with tri-banders as opposed to stacking monoband antennas, which had been discussed in the W2PV book on antennas. And Ken said, well, you take two 50-ohm antennas, you'll get 25 ohms if you put them together in a T. And then I'll just invent a toroid to bring the 25 ohms back up to 50, 2-to-1 transformer. And that, because it's toroid-based as opposed to LC circuit-based, will provide you with usefulness on 20, 15, and 10, all three bands that the TH6s are on. So that's why I named the antenna at that time a TH12VXX.
But there were three antennas.
Eventually, I found another used tri-banner for like $200, put it up there, and then what I had was a TH6 over a TH6 over a TH7, so it became a TH19DXX.
You had to make a new transformer for the three.
Fortunately, by that time, Array Solutions had come out with a stack match, which gave you the choice of choosing between 23 and 18 ohm transforming toroids. You know, three antennas is 18 ohms and two is 25. And so it was close enough. It was actually three antennas is not 18. But anyway, the point is he picked some ohm ratings that were close enough. And today, the world is filled with stacked tribanders. The article eventually wound up in the antenna handbook. And the idea that Ken and I and Dean Starr came up with has been published and put into use all around the world. So, yeah, despite the fact that I'm not an engineer, I just asked the right question, and the engineers were able to solve it, and then I wrote it up.
So you're really kind of the product marketing manager for Ham Radio Ideas.
Whenever you say something like that, it reminds me of the classic story that the difference between a computer salesman and a car salesman is that a car salesman has actually driven a car. I wouldn't presume to know enough to call myself a product manager. I just ask questions and make friends with smart people who've been able to help out.
Well, I always thought that that was actually the role of a marketing manager in a high-tech company, was that he had to be this bridge between the people that don't know even how to ask the question and the engineers who are waiting for smart questions or challenging questions. So you actually had to play this role in the middle. And sometimes I guess what you have is you have a product manager and then you have a product marketing manager, so that you have this bridge of translation that runs between the two sides to ultimately get to the engineering side of the question.
Well, that's exactly what happened with me. My partner in the company I started in the cable TV world was a physics graduate from the University of Kiel in England, had been a Harvard Business School classmate, and we started the first retail satellite TV company in the world, and then grew that into the cable TV business, which from the time I started to the time we sold out was about 12 years. And during that time, I had a lot of fun being a radio ham and the president of a cable TV company, because I could do things like take a reel end with 250 feet of hardline home from the office that was otherwise going to be junked.
That seems to be what happened. Yeah, you're talking about Channel One, right? The company that you had in Newton, Massachusetts?
Yes.
When you say it was the first satellite, this was a TVRO business, essentially, where you had the 8-foot or 12-foot dishes in the backyard for people that wanted more channels?
That's correct.
So you were the first in the United States, first in the world?
First retailer of satellite TV receiving stations for home use in the world, yeah.
Being on the bleeding edge of a new industry, what equipment was available in those days for receiving 6 gigahertz downlinks, 10 gigahertz downlinks? What were you getting?
4 gigahertz downlinks. We were looking at the SEA F1 satellite, which when we began, ESPN was on the air, was not yet on the air, and then it came on the air for 6 hours a night. It was not yet a 24-hour station. CNN was not yet on the air. There have always been people living in very rural areas in the United States where you could not get cable TV service. And as a consequence, there was a market. But when you talk about being on the bleeding edge, it was very painful, because the only receivers available that would change channels without changing crystals were very expensive. So the earliest systems we were selling with 5-meter dishes fed with half-inch 50-ohm hardline and 120 to 150 degree Kelvin low noise amplifiers were, depending on what got put together there, they were $18,000 to $25,000. It was an ugly proposition and very expensive and limited to people who had a desperate need for television.
These are the first adopters, really.
Absolutely.
What year was this? This was in the 70s?
Started the company on April 1st, April Fool's Day, which I chose specifically, in 1978.
Then the business kind of morphed into a private cable company, right? We were working in like apartment buildings, apartment complexes, things like that?
And large condominium, gated community kind of things where they had the right to keep out the cable TV company. And we wrote contracts and installed cable in the ground. So if you lived in New Seabury, Massachusetts, or Heritage Village, Connecticut, I was the president of your cable TV company.
I actually was in the cable business for a little while and became interested in private cable because, again, you could overbuild someone's franchise by being in private property. 300 units was the magic number. If you could get a 300-unit property, it actually made it worthwhile from a business standpoint to build out your own cable system in there. I started a company to build a remotely controlled cable television tap using radio paging signals. Of course, it was a complete marketing and technical disaster, but I started a whole company around that idea of eliminating the truck roll for providing new services to people that moved into apartments because of the apartment churn. Well, that sounds amazing. And of course, you built up enough units that you could actually then sell that off to the incumbent franchisee in the town?
I wasn't necessarily always the incumbent. I sold the company to Continental Cablevision, which became part of AT&T, which became part of Comcast, and I did my damnedest to get stock instead of cash, but they wouldn't let me do it that way. So I had to cash the check and become unemployed. Mind you, I wasn't unhappy. I was just unemployed.
But you had a great time doing that, not only as a business owner, but that was the kind of business where you could actually go out with your guys in a truck, or maybe you were the guy in the truck when you first started rolling out cable television services to apartment houses.
Fortunately, I was able to go to banks and get financing, and I just hired companies that would install to do the construction, except for the original early cable satellite dish installations, where my partner and I worked on those ourselves. Once we got to the point where we were in the cable TV business, we were having the cable TV construction companies do the work. Although I must say, I will never forget the fact that from one of our cable TV systems in Central Connecticut, we were watching a Long Island TV station with a stack of two single-channel Yagis, and it just wasn't working, and our local repair guy wasn't fixing it. So I grabbed my Klein belt, went down, climbed the tower, and lo and behold, I get up to the stack and I realized that the guy had mounted one of the antennas too far from the other one and had just decided to add in an extra bit of RG6, destroying the phasing, and that's why we had double signal. So I undid four nuts on U-bolts, and moved the bottom up a little bit, got rid of that extra piece of coax, put it together the way it should have been put together the first time, and the reception came back, and I was a hero to the company.
Anybody that looks you up now knows that you are an FCC lawyer expert. So if somebody's having a problem, in fact, you wrote a book, Antenna Zoning for the Radio Amateur, which I think is an ARRL book, but you also wrote one for the industry at large. How did you become an antenna zoning expert to not only write books, but also to have a large number of clients that rely on you for making sure they can run their business?
Once again, I repeat that in the land of the blind, the one-eyed are kings. I had all these friends who were engineers and radio hams, and they knew about engineering and radio. But they didn't know about law. So since I was the lawyer in the neighborhood whose phone number they had, I would get phone calls. I'm having a problem with the zoning people. Can you help me out? And I would say, of course. And then I'd go find out what it was all about. And after the first 15 or 20 antenna systems that I got permits for, I actually knew something about the process. And, I was chatting with the people at the league. One of the senior editor for books at the time was N6BV. And that was just how we got to know each other and write the stacked Tribanders article. As I say, which appeared in QST and later the antenna book. And at Dean's editing, I wrote the very first book, which was Antenna Zoning for the Radio Amateur. published in cooperation with the ARRL with their bug on the front cover. It's in its third edition now. And yes, I wrote the book for the Society of Broadcast Engineers for the industry side, which is called Antenna Zoning Professional Edition. I'm still waiting for the movie to come out, and unfortunately, Paul Newman is no longer available to play me.
Yeah, but there's got to be some young guy that could play you now, and maybe a cameo of yourself walking across like Alfred Hitchcock.
I could put on a suit and walk across the background looking like a lawyer.
And now this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener-sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors to influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer, we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcast coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. Let's go back to amateur radio now. Okay, so you've made this transition to the law, to becoming an expert in antenna zoning. What contribution have you made to the amateur radio community as a result of this knowledge? Because I hear that, for example, HOA restrictions on antennas has only gotten worse over the years, not gotten better. Is that just because of the proliferation of HOAs? You know, there's just more of them and people are buying into them. Or is it because there's maybe a sense in the general community that amateur radio operators aren't needed, that it's passe, that why do people need antennas anymore when they have cell phones?
Well, I got to tell you, occasionally when I'm on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., so there'll be some young staffer, who sees that I'm there on behalf of, with others, on behalf of the ARRL, and says, ham radio. They still do that?
Yeah, we say that at the beginning of the show every week, because people do ask that question.
So the answer is, I thought a bill introduced in Congress by the ARRL and friends of ham radio some years back would have resulted in a situation where hams were worse off with a bill than without it. I'd be happy to explain that in tedious length, but we're not going to do it right now. The fact is, I joined up with N5AUS and now at this point in the story, I'm on the ARRL board, and we the two of us wrote a new bill, which has been introduced in both the House and the Senate. It's bipartisan, and I'm working a lot on trying to get that passed, And yes, it's even more important now than it ever used to be, because a larger and larger percentage of new homes are constructed in HOA situations. The Communities Associations Institute, which is their industry group and lobbying arm, says that by 2050, 80% of new homes will be in condo associations. So I view this as an existential problem for amateur radio, because if you have no outdoor antennas, you really are hurting your ability to do long-distance HF communications of almost any kind.
Now, I interviewed last week in episode 493, Jonathan Kramer, W6JLK. You know, when it rains lawyers, right? So Jonathan was saying that what may be needed is a huge disaster, again, to demonstrate while this legislation is live, a huge disaster showing that amateur radio can save the day when everything else breaks.
I was in the office of Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, and that was one of the easiest sells I've ever seen, to get one of their staffers, two of their staffers, nodding yes, because they know about the need for HF communications, and they have fires and earthquakes and floods in Alaska, where amateur radio always plays a role. They don't have to be reminded. In fact, I suspect they're going to wind up being helpful to us in helping to get rid of the $1,400 rental fee for repeaters on National Forest Service land.
Amateur repeaters on National Forest Service land. I remember having a repeater on National Forest land in the 70s myself. And in 1970, I think the annual fee was like $120. It was a lot of money, it seemed to be in those days, in addition to the rent of the site itself. There seems to be, at least I've been reading about this, there's been a need or an interest in the HF frequencies by Wall Street traders and commodities traders to use HF for trading faster than over fiber or over the internet. Are you involved, or have you heard anything about that? And what kind of threat does that pose to amateur radio?
Yes, I've heard about this. And to me, and I'm, as by now you've learned, I'm not an engineer. The interesting technical question is that we have lived for many, many years with very high power broadcasters adjacent to the amateur bands, and we lived through it. But we now are hearing that 20 kilowatt stations near the amateur bands transmitting market information might be the death knell of the amateur bands. I'm not so sure about that, but it's not necessarily true that everyone is going to want to run 20 kilowatts. The coalition, which has petitioned the FCC for permission to do just that, does not include all of the members of that industry. But I will tell you, the funny thing about it is those guys all have the same issues with getting permission to put their towers and antennas in the air.
Well, it seems to me that from a technical standpoint, with software-defined radio, with the ability to use computers to run everything, it seems to me that we could probably create models that allow you to essentially run QRP and do trading on any of the bands. If you have multiple bands to use, you just find the MUF, the maximum usable frequency, for the trade at the time of day that you're actually doing the trade. So the 20 kilowatt transmitters is like 1970s technology versus what we could do today.
So the big interest is moving information between markets and places where traders live. So your interests are in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the New York Stock Exchange, the trading desks in London, the Paris Bourse, and Frankfurt in Germany. Those are the paths that people are interested in. And radio signals do travel faster through the ether than they do on fiber or copper. And there are two parts to the discussion. there's the information, i.e. what is the price of this commodity at this very moment? And then there's the execution of a trade, two different things, and actually done by different companies. Some companies provide information, some companies are using that information to trade.
What's the station at K1VR now?
Okay, well, I have a pair of K3s. I have an Alpha 78, an Alpha 87, an AL1200, a Henry 2K. Those are just spare amplifiers. So I'm basically an HF station. I'm really not on VHF from the house. I own walkie-talkies. Outdoors, I have a 100-foot tower with a three-stack of OptiBeams, OB16-3s. That's a boom that's 10 meters long or 33 feet. The top two of those three are rotatable on tick ring rotors. And above that is a Cushcraft 40-2 CD. Everything's fed with hardline. I have a three-element ground plane switchable array on 160 meters, which does have directionality and some gain. On 80 meters, I have a two-element vertical phased array. On 40 meters, I have a four-square, as well as the aforementioned two-element Cushcraft rotatable Yagi on a tail twister.
You're not on a 60-foot residential lot. It sounds to me like you're out in the country.
I'm in a suburb. I'm on only 1.3 acres, 48,000 square feet. It's 1.3 acres. I'm about 2 miles, not even 2 miles, less than 2 miles from Walden Pond. So if you have a vision of what Walden Pond in Concord, Massachusetts looks like, there's forest around here. I do have deer and turkeys walking through my backyard, and my beverage antenna for receiving on 160 and 80 has to be high enough so that the deer won't pull it down when they walk by.
Would Henry David Thoreau be satisfied with your contribution to Walden Pond or to the area?
I spend my life as an antenna lawyer fighting the tree huggers, I must say.
And Henry might be a tree hugger if he was alive these days.
One would think so, although remember he did heat his house with wood, which required that he chop down trees.
And make a lot of smoke.
You bet.
With a K3 pair, do you operate contests? Are you doing a SO2R?
That kind of thing, yeah. I made through about 3 million points last week in the ARRL phone contest.
So your favorite operating mode is single sideband?
Actually, my favorite might be CW, but I'm a country and western. I do CW and sideband.
So you like doing both?
Yeah. But I find the greater challenge to be 160 and 80.
The lower frequencies. And with the beverages, that gives you some nice quiet receive channels down in 160?
I can hear on 160 and 80, yeah.
Without a lot of noise.
Plus, I have gain antennas and with some directionality. So the station is better than your average guy with an inverted V at 60 feet.
Do you operate the digital modes?
I don't.
Okay.
Sorry, that's a short answer.
No, it's okay. With the K3 pair, do you have some automation that you use when you're doing some contesting so that you can listen and pounce at the same time?
Oh, yeah. In fact, with the tremendous help of Dennis Egan, W1UE, and Ed Parrish, K1EP, I'm working on the process of making my station remotable. I've just finished installing little boards in the tail twisters to make them controllable by software. The pair of Green Heron rotators are controllable by software. The K3s are controllable by software. One of my amplifiers is controllable by software, but not the others. And I do have all the antenna switching is done by a MOAS created by K1XM and the Yankee Clipper Contest Club. A MOAS is the mother of all switches, and it's remotable. So the station is gradually moving toward the point where it could be remoted and automated, and everything is computer controlled. I spent a lot of time working with Greg Cronin, W1KM. We used to have a lot of fun doing multi-multis down at his place in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And that station is completely remotable. So you'll find various friends of W1KM using his call sign or our club call down there, which is his call is W1KM. The club call is WM1K. K.
So, Fred, do you have this idea that you want to travel more, perhaps see the grandchildren, and then still operate from your iPad? Is that kind of what you're thinking?
There's some thinking along those lines. But in addition to that, I get contacted every now and then by somebody like Braden, KC1KUG, who's a high school student in New Hampshire. He'd like to operate my station remotely. And I'd like to open up my station to kids who might not have their own stations, or friends who are hams and have been forced by time and circumstance to downsize, might want a station to operate that's capable. And this station can break pileups.
That's a very nice thing to do, is to actually open up your station. You present a lot of advantage by the real estate, the quiet area. So, yeah, that sounds like a really cool thing to do. I think there's organizations, or there's a couple of groups on the internet that specialize in remote base stations, at least creating some kind of registry or maybe even common interfaces. Is that the way you're going, or are you just, this is going to be kind of custom?
I'm hoping to open it up to others. I don't know about these registries. I do know that all these things can be done because I'm the lawyer for remote ham radio.
Do you have an interest then in making your station like an LLC so that it actually has some survivability beyond the operator whose license is on the wall?
Well, I don't think I'm going to go that route. This is, after all, just your basic suburban house in a green community with a lot of trees. The reason I'm here basically is because this was about as far away from Boston as my wife would consider living, and because she was at that time still commuting to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, or as is best known in the TV world, St. Elsewhere.
Oh, really? That's St. Elsewhere?
St. Elsewhere was a Boston Catholic hospital, which was also a teaching hospital. That's St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, where she was on staff for many years and chief of outpatient at one point. Then she went into private practice.
It was a great television show in the 70s, I think. I always thought of somehow it was in Chicago, but, you know, I guess I didn't pay much attention.
There is another hospital show based in Chicago, but St. Elsewhere, I guarantee you, is in Boston.
You learn something new every day.
Well, I'll tell you something else. An internist at St. E's was the father of John Krasinski, the movie actor married to Emily Blunt. And Krasinski was an internist, and he would frequently refer to my wife for patients who needed her services. She's a psychiatrist.
This isn't a betraying a client-patient privilege.
No, I'm betraying a doctor-doctor privilege. They work with each other frequently. In fact, there's another TV story. Another doctor at St. Elizabeth's was an OBGYN who was the mother of Mindy Kaling, the TV personality. Her name was Dr. Chakalingam, and Mindy shortened it for Hollywood purposes, taking off the cha at the beginning and the at the end, and become Kaling. Chakalingam Kaling.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. Other than your remote station, I'm talking to a lot of people these days that are remotely controlling their stations, and I think for a lot of good reasons. I've actually thought about doing a remote station just so that it's not in the house, so that it's maybe somewhere else. I took you into the hills, actually putting something out in the hills there so that I wouldn't have the noise issue, but also if we decided to change locations, we'd still have a station that could be accessed from anywhere. I think it's a very popular idea to do remote stations now. But
is there a chance you might face some difficulties if the station over the green line was unmanned and vulnerable to theft and damage?
No, I think, look, this is a different question for a different time. But the green line is a line on a map. It is not a geographical boundary. And if I put the station inside like a kibbutz or a moshav property where they've got lots of orchards on the hills, I think it'd probably be okay.
Oh, okay. I mentioned it only because Ricky, K7NV, used to worry about his beverage, which went off the property of the place he lived.
Yeah, I know where he's at. And you know what? His bigger problem is that it's become a very nice neighborhood. When he built that place, it was on the edge of the town, and now he's got tract houses all the way around him.
Oh, really?
You can see that on Google Street View. If he's running into problems, it's because he's got more neighbors than he once had.
Don't we all?
That's just the way it works here. What excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now?
Probably the fact that amateur radio is so many different hobbies. There are the people who are using digital communications on sailboats, the people who are putting transponders on high altitude balloons. We still have this massive volunteer operation where we are deployed here in the Boston area for the Boston Marathon and the head of the Charles Regatta, which I participate in every year. And requires close to 300 radio hams because it's a 5-mile race on the water. We have radio hams doing exciting things with satellites and youth education. And you can't ignore the fact that packet radio, what was once new, has blossomed now into the FT-N world. And there's just so many different things. I'm fascinated by the guys who are taking Wi-Fi transmitters and to the SMA connector on the back of the box, they're attaching gain antennas and setting new distance records with mountain dog communications in a band that's shared by homeowners for Wi-Fi. There's just so much that's interesting and expanding. How can you not be excited about ham radio if you are interested in either the technical aspects of the hobby or I just like to hang around the technical people? So that's exciting too.
You were, until recently, the ARRL New England Division Director.
That's correct.
And I think you did that for 4 years?
3-year term.
3-year term. Okay. So that exposed you to a lot of radio clubs, a lot of hams. What do you think is happening in New England that hams and ham clubs are doing right to attract new members, especially younger members, to the amateur radio hobby?
New members. Well, the big effort here has been in the National New Hampshire area and spearheaded by Fred Kemmerer, AB10C, who is the current New England Division Director. But my attention is really more toward these regulatory things. And, you know, I just don't spend enough. I don't spend as much time as others spend on this topic that you're talking about, except that I do know about New England SciTech, which is just a fascinating thing. It's the equivalent of an after-school program for people who are interested in electronics and astronomy and scientific endeavors, run by a former school teacher, Bob Finney, K5TEC, who spent his career as a junior high school and high school teacher, having once been a hockey player for Harvard.
Yeah, I guess it takes people to kind of be like Mr. Wizard in order to be able to get young people excited about anything, but also about science and about radio. Does Bob have an emphasis in the New England SciTech on amateur radio itself, or does he introduce it?
There's a heavy emphasis. They have a station at the facility. He rents space in a light industrial park and runs classes and activities, and it's a beehive of activity. And I recommend it strongly to anybody with a youngster, let's say age 9 on, who wants to learn more about science, because he's a real teacher and he's just great at it. And I would encourage radio hams to support it. And there's a whole bunch of adults with an interest in education who work with him as volunteers at New England SciTech. They're in Natick, Massachusetts.
And when you were the New England division director, what did you think the greatest threat was to amateur radio in the New England area at that time, if you're from a regulatory standpoint?
It's not just New England, it's nationwide, and it's the condominiumization of the United States housing market, because no antennas, no ham radio.
And when you say that, it means that the housing density is going up as prices go up? Because when I think of condominiums, I think of apartments.
Yes, well, you may, but let me tell you that out in Colorado, there are condominiums where everyone owns 10 acres. And we have condominiums, as it were, land association in the northern part of New England, Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, where there's a road association. They're called a road association. Really, all they do is collect the trash and plow the roads. But under the bill that was introduced in the previous version put forth by the ARRL, they would have been granted the power, even though they didn't use it or want it necessarily, to regulate antennas, which was one of the terrible things about the way it was drafted. In any event, there are more and more of these associations without respect to whether it's a building that looks like an apartment building, controlling single family, not connected, not side by side housing, and controlling everything you can do in that kind of.
So I understand what you're saying. So this is a legal definition of the type of ownership, right? When I think of a condominium, I think of a condominium in America as you own the inside of the house, but the outside of the house and the common ground is owned by the association or by the management company or even owned by all the members.
Condominium turns out to be a form of ownership and not a style of building.
So that means that a guy who's on 20 acres, for example, there's an association or a group of interested parties that will tell him whether he's got Kentucky bluegrass in his yard or rows of popcorn plants.
Exactly. I did a case in Texas for a guy on 5 acres, and he was controlled by a condominium association.
I would never have thought that it would extend that far. This is where the HOAs come in.
That's right. A condominium association, homeowner association, it's two words for the same thing.
It's a definition of legal ownership. When you move into an HOA neighborhood, you in fact are just buying the inside of your building that you're living in, to a certain extent, right?
Depends on the rules and regulations of the situation you find yourself in. You may own your entire house, but there may be style, paint, other restrictions. You can't hang your clothing from an outdoor clothes rack.
You can't work on your car with the garage door open in the evening.
Correct. You can have all that. You got to take your trash cans in within 6 hours. Lots of rules and regulations that they invent. And, you know, it is true that some two are the same, but not all of them are the same.
So that's the greatest threat. From a legal standpoint, I mean, I don't think that people actually think about when they buy the property, whether they actually read all of the fine print and know, in fact, that they're signing away their rights to have amateur radio antennas or even a pink flamingo in the front yard.
It's true that they get a wad of paper and they don't necessarily read it.
And that's where you come in. Do you have advice that you'd give, Fred, to new or returning hams to the hobby? There's a bunch of us who've left it. We came in as kids, but we had to raise a family, and we're coming back. What kind of advice would you give to us?
Okay, I'd break it down into a couple of things. Number one, more land is gooder. Number two, ham radio is many hobbies within a hobby. Find something that you're really interested in and sort of learn for yourself, whether you're a talker, an experimenter. I know two brothers. One has next to no interest in getting on the air, except for the purpose of testing out these very clever things he does with antennas and radios. The other one is an engineer. He understands what his brother is doing, but he really likes to get on the air and operate. So even two brothers can have very different interests. Find your interest, because there are so many aspects of ham radio that can be so fascinating.
Well, that sounds like a great place to stop. I want to thank you so much, Fred. I know it's been a long time since we tried to get this together, and I'm glad we finally did. I want to thank you so much for joining me on QSO today. And with that, I want to wish you 73.
It's been my great pleasure.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Fred. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in K1VR in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the Sponsor Transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.